Welcome to another episode of Respond to Resilience. Along with my co-host, Dr. Stacey Raymond, I'm David Dashinger. And we invite you to like and subscribe to our YouTube channel, Respond to Resilience. We're on Facebook, Respond to Wellness, Inc., and on bbsradio.com. We also have a brand new website with all our past episodes, respondertv.com. And we're going to be speaking today with Matt Domiancic, who's called the Tactical Chaplain, and he'll be speaking about how to enjoy a career that provides deeper meaning to your spiritual life, and he's going to share some strategies for transitioning from a responder career and at the same time staying highly connected with the job and the mission. We'll also learn what a patrol chaplain is and the meaning of spiritual weightlifting right after this. In this family, more of us die by our own hands than by the hazards of the job. In this family, up to a quarter of 911 dispatchers have symptoms of PTSD. In this family, our mental health and wellness are in crisis while responders are quietly suffering. In this family, many struggle with job-related stress, burnout, trauma, sleep disruption, substance abuse, and marriage problems. In this family, we can help the helpers. With vital information and resources, resilience strategies, and success stories of overcoming the obstacles. In this family, no one is alone. Welcome to Respond to Resilience with co-hosts retired Lieutenant David Dashinger, Dr. Stacey Raymond, and Bonnie Lumley, LCSW EMTB. And I want to welcome Matt Domiancic to Respond to Resilience. Great to see you, Matt.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
I'm going to read your bio, give everybody an opportunity to learn a little bit about your background. Matt volunteers as a chaplain and peer support for police agencies in Los Angeles. He's also a volunteer for nonprofits that support police officers in crisis, as well as those that are injured and disabled. Matt believes that all first responders can have careers that provide deeper meaning and add richness to their spiritual lives if approached in the right manner. Matt is a medically retired police officer that worked patrol, peer support, SWAT, and as a full-time police academy instructor. Matt was the wellness coordinator for his agency, integrating sports nutrition, strength, conditioning, stress management, combatives and scenario training, and he regarded officers as tactical athletes, which I think is a fabulous thing. I think most responders should be regarded as tactical athletes. Matt was also concurrently a collegiate strength coach at Yale and Georgetown Universities while a full-time officer. Later, he was a strength coach and mental skills trainer for NFL combine athletes. Matt has an MS in forensic science, an MS in sports psychology, and an MA in pastoral theology with a concentration in spiritual direction. So given that bio, I know we have a lot to talk about. And Stacey, I'm going to let you kick it off.
Okay. Thanks, David. So Matt, what exactly is a tactical chaplain?
Tactical chaplain came about because I started doing some of these podcast interviews and I had no social media or website and someone actually wanted to get in touch with me. And I also had another friend, Mark Polymeropoulos, a well-decorated CIA guy who had heard some of my interviews and said, like, man, you need a podcast so people can reach out to you, or a website. So some friends wanted to buy me a website and were kicking around names because they wanted something to be catchy and easy to remember if you said it on a podcast. So tacticalchaplain.com is what they came up with and thought was cool. And I was a little reserved at first because I didn't want to sound silly or like, because there are people in our profession, especially like ex-SWAT and special forces guys that can like over macho type stuff on the internet, a lot of workout type stuff. Like it's all about gut checks and being a badass. And I was like, I want to, you know, I don't want to have that type of image, but they're like, dude, you're a former cop, you're in the lifting, fighting, shooting, and you have a background in psychology and spirituality too. So you should be okay with that name. And so far, most people like it. So it's just a catchy name, throw tactical in front of anything and maybe some cops will listen a little better. Or it'll be like, what's the tactical and chaplain makes people wonder
Correct.
What
Right.
the heck? Because I will say this, if you guys are familiar with Kevin Gilmartin, when he gives
Yes.
word during his seminars, he does word association for cops. And he'll be like, cops are see all the negativity, all the evil, so they're very sarcastic and have dark humor. So when he puts up the word scout leader or priest, a cop says pedophile. Well, chaplain, I will tell you, is not much better. It's not pedophile, but when I get introduced as a chaplain to a new group of people, usually people like clear out the room like there's an active shooter call. So there's a big stigma to overcome.
Yes, and we're interested in that conversation. We're going to be doing an episode on spirituality in the in emergency services, and the door's starting to open. There are, as we're finding out, more and more people who are actually spiritual while they're doing the job, or it's part of the complete experience. So, and I love how that's become part of your retirement mission. So you've transitioned from being an active police officer, and in that transition, I think it's a great example for other people to hear about, because you maintained a purpose and a connection in that next phase. Because I know sometimes retired responders can feel like they're a burden to their family. They're feel deep emotional pain leaving the job, and of course there's a potential for suicide. So, what path did you take to stay connected with the police officers and firefighters after you retired?
So it didn't come till a significant amount of time later, because when I got retired, my therapist in the DC area told me actually I needed to disconnect from cops and veterans and athletes because my identity was so much wrapped up in that, and my health was destroyed. When I got retired, I had a lot of problems. So I moved out to California for functional and integrative medicine, and I literally had two doctor's appointments per day for about 2 years. And that's all I really had the energy for, as I was so, my immune, digestive, endocrine system collapsed, and I had, and I still do have permanent intestinal damage, which causes some other issues, like chronic pain. So my first couple of years was just patching myself back together, then going back to grad school for sports psychology because I wanted to complement the strength and conditioning and background in nutrition and lifting, fighting, and shooting. And I wanted to add some more knowledge with performance psychology, stress management, self-regulation. And then when I finished that master's, my medical benefits and disability pay got cut off for over 3 years because they wanted me to go back on drugs rather than do the holistic care. So I didn't get a PhD, which was my plan. But long story short, eventually get the third master's in pastoral theology, which was only possible because I got a full ride. And that opened the door without it directly being intentional to be able to volunteer as a police and fire chaplain and do things like this. But my goal was always to be involved with first responders, veterans, and athletes because I knew even like when I was a college coach, I did sports ministry, and you know that athletes are a subculture, cops are a subculture, veterans are a subculture. And unless, most of the time, unless you have a foot in the door, like you're gonna have a really hard time building trust and rapport and having them understand that you have what we would say is cultural competency about their world. Do you understand them and their lifestyle? So because of the stigmas to mental health and even self-care and wellness, I knew even when I was a cop, that's what I was trying to kind of normalize and destigmatize for my buddies. And when I was a coach, trying to normalize being more in touch with your thought life, your emotional life, your spiritual life. And so the mission has been the same. It just, my roles have changed, if that
Sure,
makes sense.
absolutely. And we talked about this a little bit offline, but I'm curious, like, what does your day look like when you're going out and doing your chaplain work with departments in the LA area?
So because of the stigma, and also just the most important things are cultural competency. And I think this is chaplains and this is mental health professionals. You've got to understand cops and their way of life. So one, cultural competency. Two, building long-term relationships of trust. Cops never trust anybody that easy. Add in the last 2 years of COVID, the BLM movement, the anti-police narratives. It's really hard to gain their trust. And the third thing that I think that at least chaplains and mental health professionals need to do is share some self-disclosure in an authentic manner of who they are outside of their role of a mental health professional or just like a religious figure. And the only way to do all three of those things, to me, is ride along at least once a week, in addition to another station visit at least once a week. And if you can observe training, in-service training, SWAT training, canine training, you got to hang out in the trenches with them. You're not the guru. You're the student. It's like missionary work. You're a ministry of presence, and I'm here to learn from you. Police culture has some similarities across the country, but every station, every department, every shift has its own unique culture. And you're only going to learn about that by zipping your mouth and being a good listener and hanging out with them sometimes for 1 or 2 or 3 years before some people will trust you. And you have to be there regularly and consistently on all shifts. You cannot just show up during the day and hang out with the brass. You cannot just do a half ride along on the day shift in the safe area. Like, you got to ride the midnight graveyard shift, the evening shift. You got to be willing to sit in back if it's a two-man car. You got to sit in on briefings, roll calls. Everybody calls it different in different parts of the country. But it's time in the trenches to develop cultural competency, build trust and rapport and long-term relationships, and allow them to get to know who you are outside of whatever their stereotype. So like my first department, when I got introduced as chaplain, the briefing room cleared out like there's an active shooter call. And it wasn't until a sergeant and one of the SWAT guys who would be in on a briefing that I did Krav Maga and Muay Thai with many years ago would be like, hey, the new chaplain, he used to train at Elite and do Krav Maga and Muay Thai with me. He played college football, was a college strength coach. Oh, and he's a retired cop that did SWAT and was a police academy instructor. Right. There's a little bit of my humanity that's exposed. And then a few people might turn around and ask, where'd you work or where'd you play football? And maybe even like they drop an F-bomb. And when somebody drops an F-bomb around me, I'm like, good. The filters are coming down. They're being themselves rather than people get uptight and apologize because like the chaplain's here. So time in the trenches to build those three things, I think, are the most important for a chaplain.
So you got introduced as somebody who's cool, and that kind of bridged your connection with them, right?
It did, yeah. For some of them.
For some of them, all right. But they had to take some time to observe you and make sure that you fit in, right?
Yeah.
Our mission at Responder Wellness, Inc. is to subsidize or provide free of charge safety equipment and wellness services to first responders, including police officers, firefighters, EMS personnel, and 911 operators throughout Connecticut. Resources include scholarships to train new EMTs, a responder and veteran-only AA group in Danbury, Connecticut, as well as police vests, a fire and EMS boot program, yoga classes, gym memberships, and t-shirts. The founder of Responder Wellness, Inc. co-leads a peer support group sponsored by Fairfield County Trauma Response Team. Responder Wellness, Inc. is a nonprofit 501c3. Find us on the web at responderwellness.org, on Facebook at Responder Wellness, Inc., or email us responderwellness@gmail.com. Responder Wellness, Inc., putting responders first.
You know, you were talking about taking a break from police work and rebuilding yourself physically. How did you segue into, you know, mental health and spirituality? I know you said that you started taking classes and whatnot, but was there anything that inspired you to take into consideration post-traumatic stress, or, you know, what the job can do to you emotionally, psychologically? And then how did you then take that next step into spirituality and looking at the spiritual aspect of being a first responder?
I got into being a first responder because of spirituality. So it started before I was a cop.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So when I was an undergrad, long story short, I had a number of football injuries, and one of them was ripping my calf in half, and they thought I would never run again. So my whole dream of at the time being in the FBI or going back into the military, got threatened to be taken away. And the longer story short is I realized I had made football my God and my priority, even though I was a practicing Catholic, still going to church and praying and things like that. But I said, at that point, 20 or 21 years old, I said, what's it really mean to give your life to God? And I started this journey of reading books and meeting with priests and pastors and rabbis and professors on campus. Anyone that was religious, I was like, what's it mean? What's faith mean to you? What's it mean to give your life to God? And then later on, I was discerning between full-time ministry, which at the time was like, am I going to go to seminary and be a priest or becoming a psychologist after the forensic science master's? And I decided not to be a Fed because of my exposure to some Feds in grad school and also on an internship training with a lot of special forces and SWAT guys and some Feds. And the Feds were not the runner and gunners and the alpha males like these special forces dudes or metropolitan SWAT guys. I was like, you know, what's a great way to do ministry and and learn about psychology and spirituality? Mm-hmm. Go be a cop. And later in life, if I decide to go into ministry full time and study theology or psychology, I will have all of these real world experiences because I have many friends. And even at that time, I had a deep interest in psychology starting in undergrad. My dad discouraged me from studying it, but I loved reading psychology on my own. So I had friends, anybody that was in the field I liked talking to. But a lot of them went from suburbia to undergrad to master's and or PhD, then to hanging a shingle and doing therapy. And the same with, say, pastors that go get a master's of divinity and they're 23. They may not have a ton of life experience and now they're preaching and teaching. I was kind of like, and I had a blessed life growing up in Ohio and Pittsburgh. I got to go to Air Force Academy, Colgate, grad school. I hadn't had real hardship other than my football injuries. So I wanted to experience violence and addictions and mental illness and all the things you'll see as a cop to learn about them, but that's an opportunity to serve. And I also recognize that everybody's going to be having a bad day. Victims and the criminals are not having a good day when the cops show up. Mm-hmm. So I went into police work as a ministry.
Okay. How did you maintain that lens and to see your work as a ministry or being spiritual? And then how do you impart that to other first responders now to help them kind of look at the world and their job through the same lens?
The second question is more difficult to answer, and it's very individualized based on these long-term relationships, because people almost want to have, especially cops or people that some people meet me that are in charge of, say, post courses or might want to have a conference and be like, Matt, what's the prescription? I'm like, I don't care if it's nutrition, exercise, your psychological orientation, your spirituality. There's so many independent variables in a person's life and preferences that I tell people, actually, if it's diet, supplements, workouts, and somebody tells you this is the right way for everybody at all times, or this one martial art is the best thing for all cops at all times, like if somebody has a one answer solution for everybody at all times, I tell them it's a red flag. Like, so the more I can develop long-term relationships and learn about them and have them open up to me individually or in, say, in small groups or with partners, then there's more an opportunity to maybe tailor whatever suggestions I might give them after they ask, because I don't run around giving unsolicited advice, because that's one thing cops don't like either. They want to be heard. And I've heard this repetitively, especially when I used to be a chaplain for a rehab center just for cops and firemen. And I would get thanked basically for, you listen really well and I feel like you hear me. You don't judge me. Mm-hmm. You don't give me unsolicited advice. And I don't have to explain the terminology or the calls to you, where with an experience with another chaplain or even the therapist at those rehabs, they have to stop the flow of their story to explain what this call means rather than, hey, I was on this type of call and you just, yeah, I get it. Like, keep going. Don't slow up. But if you want to go back for me, how I integrated it, I was in something called spiritual direction, which was mentioned. Most people don't know what it is. But when I got all serious in undergrad, I would eventually find priests that also were therapists. So they could talk about spirituality and psychology. I bugged the hell out of them. You know, like I loved meeting them. I loved devouring books. I would find as many mentors as possible. I gave up TV in undergrad. So like the whole time I was a cop, I didn't own a TV. I had a mattress on the floor, a bookshelf, and a desk with candles. And like after my shifts, for example, I had routines. Mm-hmm. Like in Connecticut and in DC, like if there's a church that's open, I would finish my shift. And if I had time before I rolled in to turn in my paper, I stopped to light a candle and pray in silence. And then I would drive home in silence. And then I had like a contemplative prayer, basically like a meditation practice. I would journal things that I was thankful for on that shift, whether it's a conversation with a partner, or you met some sweet person in the community, or thank God we got to intercede on this situation and prevent something. So like gratitude journaling, meditating, different types of prayer and meditation. And I had no TV and there was no smartphones back then. So, and then I would reach out to say my friend that I might've told you guys about before we started, the one with the PhD and the MDiv and the MFT. I called her all the time to talk about things that might bother me.
I see.
A friend can't be your personal therapist, but man, when somebody knows you really well and they're a therapist, they can still give you some good advice. In addition to, spiritual directors usually see people once a month or twice a month. Mine, I had an email and a phone call relationship with. So like at the end of a shift, if there's something that's bothering me, I'd send an email to him, maybe an email to her. I had different outlets to try to process the trauma and the misery or the unknowns. Like how, for faith-wise, how's God involved in this? Or just even if you're not a person of faith, like how does something so terrible happen to such good and innocent people? So rather than the traditional self-medicate, which is what most people unconsciously do in these professions because that's what we were trained. Mm-hmm. You're on your FTO and it's like, if this ain't for you, suck it up, buddy. And everybody drinks, or I say sleeps with people they shouldn't sleep with, and buys toys that they can drive fast and keep pumping the adrenaline. And we normalize too much, at least back then, being the tough guy, the guy that works tons of overtime, doesn't sleep, is hooking up with chicks. Like you're cool, rather than, no, you're being an idiot, man. Like we should be taking better care of ourselves.
Matt, what you're describing is it's so interesting. It's almost like a monastic life you led for a while there. and it's beautiful in a way, because what better way to focus on, you know, your work and to digest it, to process it with your support network. I wanted to ask, do you find in your travels, what kind of interest is there in spirituality? And is there like even a thirst for it?
I think if we could do a better job with both spirituality and psychology, if we could inform and teach cops about it, because there's stigma, say, even behind the word sports psychology, since I have a back. When you hear the word psychology, you think broken, crazy, weak, fit for duty. That's like what most cops' minds go to. Chaplain, religion, spirituality goes to Bible thumper, altar call, trying to baptize me, going to judge me. I can't cuss around you. So we need to do a better job of explaining and letting people experience things. We can't do death by PowerPoint with psychology or spirituality. That's why I think retreats and workshops or even little things, maybe even during roll call, to let somebody experience a little bit of gratitude journaling or meditation. But so like my definition of spirituality, if you haven't heard me say it before, spirituality is the living out of your most important values and beliefs. If you're religious, plug them in. But if not, you know, you have other values you're living out. Spirituality is how you relate to your community. It's how you relate to humanity. And who more than cops is involved in the nitty-gritty of a community? And who more than cops, in my experience, whether they say they're spiritual or not, understands the highs and lows of the things that human beings going through, because they're immersed in that stuff all the time. And they're some of the most, I don't care if you're, if it, the dude sleeved up tattoos and works the graveyard shift in the ghetto. I've seen guys like that be the most empathetic and compassionate to somebody after a rape or after a murder. The media and the politicians don't see that. I saw it as a cop. I see it now as a chaplain.
Right.
Spirituality is how you relate to your higher power or God, if you believe in one. And spirituality is also part of the framework for how you continue to find meaning and purpose through pain, through change, through loss, adversity, and suffering, which is common to everyone. And cops are immersed in that.
Sure.
So what if we could teach people different definitions of spirituality that are detached from their stereotype of it?
Right. How do we make it okay? How do we make it okay for first responders to have a conversation or consider their spirituality or their psychology, their emotionality? Like, how do we influence that? I mean, what words of advice do you have? Like, what would you say to first responders to get them to maybe think about it? Let's say you have their attention and their respect. What would you say to them?
Well, me personally, I'm all the time, if it's applicable, I mean, I try to get guys and girls to be open to going to therapy and sit there and say, dude, I've been to tons of therapy and it works well. And I've had mentors or the spiritual directors and other people that I've leaned on. I mean, I don't care what you think about me, but it's at least for me, it's only after they get to know me and then that I have some street credibility that, like, I can still shoot, I can still lift. They wouldn't mind if I jumped in to back them up if we did get in a fight. That hasn't happened yet, but you know, you have to have some credibility.
You have credibility, and then you say therapy worked for me. You know, you might want to try it, something like that.
Yoga's not for wimps, and meditation is cool. Art, there are cops that like art or playing musical instruments or doing woodworking, gardening. All of these things can be spiritual practices or grounding or centering practices that train the parasympathetic nervous system, that give some balance to your life, that turn off the analytical mind and allow you to be present in the moment. Mm-hmm. Which, when we are present in the moment, to me, that is prayer. That is prayer. Prayer is not all this intellectual mumbo jumbo. So, I mean, I see it from psychology and spirituality, all those types of things, having balance in your life. It's a hard, this is tough, but if we had more people that came out, like, there are ex-Navy SEALs and Green Berets that teach yoga. Right. Now, if I could bring them into a police department, are you going to say the Navy SEAL is a dork or a wimp?
No.
You know, that's teaching meditation or yoga or the journaling. And there's, well, put it this way, there's also tons of cops that have been in shootings, that have been on SWAT teams, gang unit, narc units, that have done real police work, that do different things, like I just mentioned that list. But people don't want to talk about it because of the stigma still.
Yes.
So if more people would talk about it, and if you're a supervisor that's respected, because a lot of supervisors are leaders, managers in law enforcement may not be. But if you are, why don't you stand in front of a briefing or roll call or do a department video and say, like, when I was going through my marriage or my divorce, I was drinking and this and that, and I went to marriage and family therapist, and it saved my life. No shame in it. If more people would just be open about whatever they've done, rather than the negative self-medicating, numbing, and distracting yourself from whatever adversity you're facing. I mean, that's one way. I would really like it if there were more retreats and workshops, or if departments had wellness budget to allow them to experience this, because we have retreats, but you have to have PTSD, addiction, or suicidal ideation. And then you can apply and go do yoga, meditation, journal, art projects, nature walks, outdoor activities, talk to a therapist, small group sharing, and it saves some people's lives or gives them a fighting chance. But if we know cops, firemen, and veterans experience these things from being, as I call it, immersed in the suffering and trauma of others, and their misery cup overflows sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why do we wait till they're broken? Like, let's give swimming lessons for the trauma and adversity.
Well, yeah, right.
Earlier in a career.
Yeah, proactive.
And very proactive. And myself, mm-hmm. Dr. John Becknell, Father Jim Clark, Dr. Stephanie McKenney, these are people that are police psychologists and spiritual directors, theology teachers, depth psychologists. We were doing retreats prior to COVID that were more proactive and allowing you to experience some of these things, not after you're broken, but like two,
right.
three, 5 years into your career. And, or even I'll give you an example. Last year, I took a number of cops from Los Angeles on a fishing retreat to Missouri. A ministry supported, covered all the costs. I took a number of cops to go fishing for 4 days, fishing, clay pigeon shooting, being in nature in Missouri around people
right.
that loved cops. And like on the way out, they're like, where are we going to go out at night? Where are we going to get to drink and see girls? I'm like, guys, we are 2 hours from the nearest town. We're in the middle of nowhere. But by the end of the retreat, I said, would you have rather been somewhere that we did the typical thing when a cop goes to a conference and you go party at night? Or would you have wanted this? They're like, we want to do this so bad that we're going to go back and tell everybody it was horrible. So if you do it next year, that we get to go again.
That's right.
Fairfield County Trauma Response Team is a nonprofit alliance of mental health professionals dedicated to helping first responders heal from trauma, tragedy, and stress. We help as they manage community crises and the everyday demands of ensuring public health and safety. Established in 2011, FCTRT was formed in response to a call for emotional help from the Stamford Fire Department after a traumatic fatal fire. Less than a year later, the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting occurred, and members again served the first responder community. Most recently, COVID-19 created a need for our support. We provide free educational presentations, pro bono sessions to deal with community disasters, and an extensive referral service to trauma-informed psychotherapists. If you're a responder in Fairfield County and need help dealing with duty-related stress, please reach out to us so you can continue to do the job you love. Visit our website at fctrt.org or find us on Instagram at Fairfield County TRT.
Matt, do you think that this proactive way of thinking, do you think it's more a West Coast mentality? Because it's hard to find this on the East Coast. Can you comment on that? At least that's my impression.
I'm saying it's not even happening out here. Out here, it's the same thing. Chaplains, peer support, mental health professionals are dispatched to critical events. Or after an individual is identified as broken.
As broken,
We're doing everything on the back end. And it's a long trajectory before you get PTSD, addiction, divorce, suicidal ideation.
Yeah. Right.
But we're waiting till the end. And I say 90% of the emails I get from peer support or chaplain organizations are training on PTSD, addiction, and suicide. And if you just show up at police stations and do briefing and roll call training on PTSD, addiction, and suicide, guess what? The cops don't want to talk to the chaplains, peer support, or mental health professionals if that's all you're doing. There's very few. Seattle PD had a proactive, well, as bad as things are up there,
mm-hmm.
they had full-time lieutenant, two sergeants, and a couple officers, and they integrate fitness, nutrition, defensive tactics,
right.
training on sleep quality, and other wellness things that are not just waiting until you're broken. And that also destigmatizes talking to peer support or the wellness unit if they're mm-hmm. being more proactive. I think San Antonio PD does some things. There's a great guy out of there that they have a peer support training business. But as far as like, I just came from a peer support meeting today for an agency that does well. And we were talking about this again. It's been on and off for 3 years. Let's be more proactive and bring in yoga, meditation, massage, have free blind billing, anonymous therapy. Let's normalize therapy by everybody can go and the department never knows.
Right.
But the problem
yeah.
is always budget. Like you
got
to
sure.
convince,
right.
you got to convince higher ups. And now we're defunded and the economy's messed up. So it might be more difficult, but We also have record number of cops being ambushed, attacked, like more than ever. People resist arrest, flee, don't comply.
Right.
Never before have cops been constantly filmed on calls and heckled on and off riots, mm-hmm. depending where you are, working 10, 12 days in a row, 12-hour shifts of riots, and then having Black Lives Matter and Antifa websites putting your family's name and address that the public doesn't understand that happens after a lot of – once the media or a politician highlights an incident, somebody – they attempt to find those officers' names, and then they have journalists showing up at their house. Then you got to worry, is somebody going to do something to my spouse and children when I'm at work? Mm-hmm. The stressors now, more than ever, with cops being dehumanized, even the churches and the synagogues flew BLM banners during COVID because that was the virtuous thing to do, was have talks. You show up and they're talking about, we got to pray for all these victims of these police brutality and racist issues we have, like not based on fact, even the spiritual communities. So you have media, social media, and many cops, friends and family turning on them in the last 2 years. So I think there's going to be a study 10 years from now looking at the fallout from starting in 2019 to 2022 of even more mental health issues and maybe sadly even more suicides of police officers.
So to kind of continue on the thread of what you were talking about, I'm going to give you this amazing opportunity. You're going to have the opportunity to design a police academy class. And what would you include in the training and the activities? What would it look like in your world?
So most, not all, but most places traditionally are 6 months. But there's other places that are only 3 months. And then there's other places where you get certified by just going to community college classes. And that's something we discussed before we started recording. People don't understand just how little little training some cops get, or how bad, really bad, defensive tactics, shooting, driving, that's worthless, and they don't get enough, even though it's bad, and you don't get enough hours to develop the motor skills in an automatic fashion that you can then make better decisions. Or there's something called training scars, some scenario training before people have their shooting and their martial arts and their handcuffing down, they overwhelm them and think, let's totally stress them out. Well, read Dustin Solomon. He has the brain science of firearms training and some other stuff. Buildingshooters.com is the website. If you get stressed out in training and beat, and I remember in the Connecticut Academy, I intuitively knew, they thought it was funny to get people killed during scenarios. I'm like, this is not good training to stress people out during the academy, get them killed and tell them you're dead, you did bad. Whatever your state's requirement is, if that's 6 months, check the box on all the death by PowerPoint and the liability stuff. Have it at least 2 more months after that, when you're done with all the agency and the city and the county covering their ass. Because let's be real, a lot of academy training is your organization covering their ass, and you might get thrown under the bus and they're going to say, we trained you on that. Training is not on day 32. It was on page 3 of PowerPoint session number 4. Like, that's not training. That's just information. Finish all that stuff and then have at least 2 months where every day you do defensive tactics, arrest and control, tactical firearms. And I mean not marksmanship. Punching holes on paper just to prove you can operate a gun with no stress during the daylight is not gunfighting. You need shooting and moving, shooting in and around a vehicle, in dark, at a moving target, under stress. So defensive tactics, tactical shooting, and a true strength conditioning session where they should hire civilian strength conditioning coaches. And then in between your lifting, your fighting, and your shooting, it could be just 10 minutes of a gratitude journal. Go on to the shooting. 10 minutes of breath work. Go on to the strength conditioning. Then we're going to do 10 minutes of yoga or Tai Chi, or have a psychologist come in and talk about post-traumatic growth and how the adversity that you face can be used for something that down the road, just like they say, a bone that gets broken heals stronger. You know, there's studies after studies on post-traumatic growth on prisoners of war and other people that have been through cancer and whatever types of hardships. If they're given the tools on how to process that stuff, you can learn lessons and grow. So I say we have 2 months at the end where you're getting enough hours to actually learn these motor skills of better shooting, better fighting. And some people may not like those terms, so let's be real, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. Better handcuffing. And then some scenario training, but appropriate scenario training, where they're getting a little dose of stress and the odds are they're able to complete the scenario successfully with a little bit of stress, because that's what the brain science is saying is appropriate, you know, to give them confidence and make better decisions versus let's overwhelm them and beat their ass and think it's funny, you know?
Yeah, right. That's such a good idea to integrate the, you know, the gratitude journal and the yoga and the meditation and whatnot. What's the chance of that ever happening? I mean, is there any place that you know of where they're doing that? Because then there would, you know, those options are there from the beginning, you know, interwoven into their tactical experiences.
Yeah,
you know, you have a bad day. You can go and this is an option for you, and you know how to do it because you've been exposed to it from the beginning. It's almost like giving permission to have that as an outlet, as opposed to acting out, drinking, you know, having affairs, et cetera.
If they did that academy like that, I guarantee you, if they followed up the next year to 2 years on injury claims, sick days, use of force incidents, payouts by these large cities and counties. Even when use of force is justified, if the cop looks like they're spazzing out, you know, it doesn't look as pretty as maybe it could be, but no violent encounter can be pretty, but it can be a little more controlled if you're better trained.
Mm-hmm.
And also the better trained people are, the better you are at de-escalating situations. It's the officers that are fit, that are confident in being able to go hands-on and shoot, that can talk longer and make better decisions under stress.
Mm-hmm.
It would cost less money. The Breonna Taylor shooting was $12 million payout. Go on, look at all these different payouts that cities do. How much training could $12 million pay for?
You're right. Right. To do it up front, to save from poor tactical decisions or behavior, whatever.
Yeah, I mean, jujitsu alone, a department in Georgia just did jujitsu alone. They put them through X amount of jujitsu sessions, and then they partnered with the school in the community. And the people that consistently went to jujitsu, less injuries, less sick days, less use of force incidents. Like, there's all these benefits that save the department money, and the community is getting better community policing.
Sure. All right. Makes sense.
It's a win-win. Jumping back to your mission now as a tactical chaplain, offline you mentioned another term, which was patrol chaplain. And so how's that different? We were talking about chaplains that show up, you know, maybe hang out with the brass, or show up at, you know, the big incident, or the death, line of duty death. But what's that like? What's a patrol chaplain?
So a few departments that I know of do this, and now as I've been networking with more chaplains across the country, and then Jeremy Wade, who used to run the peer support for Seattle PD, is very well networked with chaplains as well. A lot of traditional chaplains are more for the community. So they get called to help when somebody has an accident or an unexpected death, and they're not there for the cops. Or even if they come to the station, they want to have breakfast with the chief or a captain. Or they come to pray just at religious ceremonies and events.
Mm-hmm.
So all you do, if you hang out with brass, pray at events, and talk to the community, the cops don't know who you are, and you might even be, quite frankly, just stigmatizing yourself. So patrol chaplain is, and now that I've been doing this patrol chaplain thing for two different departments, it takes a long time for them to get used to, wait, you're here for us? Because the second department, I said what I talked about before, cultural competency, building long-term relationships of trust, and exposing some of your humanity so they get to know you outside of a religious mm-hmm. role. Mm-hmm. I said it worked with the first department. So the second department, I'm going to ride every weekend. And actually, I was riding 2 days, every Friday, every Saturday. And I was riding graveyard because I was told in that agency, some graveyard shifts are for rookies, you're forced, or senior guys that want to be lazy. That's a lot of departments. You had to be basically approved by supervisors to be this midnight graveyard shift because you were expected to get guns, hunt gang activity, stolen cars, and be proactive all the way to the end of the shift. So these are the go-getters. So I start riding every weekend. They're like, and I'm getting interrogated. What are you here for? You're here for us. You're not here for religion. You don't get paid. The joke was months later, I found out on the fishing trip to Missouri, some of them said, hey, you know, we thought you were a fed. We thought you were a rat or a mole because what chaplain is for the cops? We've never heard of a chaplain for the cops or somebody that comes around that much. So it was so foreign to have somebody that was there for them, that was not preaching, that was not praying, that was just trying to learn from them and support and encourage them and affirm that there's still meaning in their work. But you can't even do that until you have credibility. Like, zip it, man. You got to build their trust before you can say anything. So a patrol chaplain, I say it's more like the military embedded model. A military chaplain goes through a boot camp. It might be watered down. You know, the lawyers, the doctors, the chaplains go through a watered down boot camp. But they go through something to be initiated into the community to gain some cultural competence. And also, like, you had to do something to be a part of this organization. They live on base and they deploy with the troops, and the troops know they're there for them. They're not there for the citizens of the other country we're defending. Mm-hmm. I'm sure they could help, but most police chaplains are seen as outsiders that live off base. When they come on base, they talk to the brass, which alienates you more from the troops, mm-hmm. the frontline patrol guys. Mm-hmm. Or they just come out when it's convenient for them to pray at an event or do something for the community. And we need both. I would love to have a team of clergy, ordained clergy in every city and county or district, because they're going to know their congregations. Have them be have the clergy be the community chaplains that respond to incidents in the community, especially if you can tie them up with the same faith tradition and maybe even the same congregation. Have patrol chaplains that don't have to be ordained clergy, but do have some a strong faith life, a deep background check. They go through a bunch of peer support training and some decent chaplain training, which is a whole other story. And let's recruit more retired first responders and veterans who have the cultural competency piece, have more time than a lot of ordained clergy because they're responsible for their flock. The police department gets what time they have left over outside of their flock and their family. First responders miss the communities when they retire. This is where part of the problem is. So what if we had more retired first responders recruited onto peer support teams and right. as chaplains?
Yeah, absolutely. That would really give the retired first responders like a continued connection with their department. And they feel like, you know, because of everything that they've been through, they could counsel, you know, the active first responders, and they would have the respect, right, you know, instantly because they were just a part of that department.
Yes.
So many retirees feel no sense of purpose. They feel useless, and they don't know how to define themselves. So I would love to see retirees become at least a part of peer support. You know, I don't. It depends on where they stand with their spirituality as far as becoming a chaplain. But, mm-hmm. I mean, that would be great, too.
Well, Matt, as we wrap up, any other thoughts you have or anything you want to share that we didn't cover?
Not that I can think of, but if there's anybody out there that I can help in any little way, whether that's an individual first responder or an agency, like, please reach out. I am happy to be a listener. If you got to unload something, or if you want my opinion, I'll give you my opinion on anything that we discussed today.
Great. Yeah, we have your Instagram handle up there, and also your website was up a second ago. Matt, this has been an amazing conversation. We probably only touched on about half of the things that we could have, but really, really amazed and impressed and in awe of what you're doing, especially you've kind of created it yourself from a place where you were kind of putting yourself back together. And now what you're doing is unparalleled, I think, out there in the
very progressive.
Yeah. Wish you continued success with, you know, what you're doing out there with these agencies, and we will be spreading the word on our end as well. So thank you for being with us today. It's been a fantastic conversation.
Super. Thanks to you guys for having me. It's a real privilege that any time to get to talk to first responders.
On that note, we'd like to invite you to like and subscribe to our YouTube channel, Responder Resilience. We're on Facebook, Responder Wellness, Inc., on bbsradio.com, and our website is respondertv.com. So on behalf of Dr. Stacey Raymond and Bonnie Rumeli, we'd like to invite you to stay safe and be kind to yourself. Take care.